It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A movie about Fred Rogers starring Tom Hanks being filmed in Pittsburgh. And the first complete biography of Fred Rogers has now been published. It's titled The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers, and the author joins us now. Maxwell King is the CEO of the Pittsburgh Foundation and former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Full disclosure, WESA is among the many organizations in the region that receives financial support from the foundation. Max, welcome to The Confluence.
It's great to be with you, Kevin.
Fred Rogers passed away in 2003. What made you want to write the biography now, the 50th anniversary of the start of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood or something else?
Well, actually, when I started the book, which was, it took me 7 years to write it. And when I started it, I wasn't even thinking about, I thought it would be done long before the 50th anniversary. I did not appreciate how much work would go into it. But it was about maybe 4 years after Fred had died. And I was about to retire from the Heinz Endowments, where I'd been working here in Pittsburgh. And I was kind of worried about what I would do in retirement. And I ran into Archabbot Douglas Nowicki, who's the Chancellor of St. Vincent, where the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Children's Media is. And he asked me to come out and be the director of it for a couple of years, help raise money, get programs started. And after a few months there, I was meeting with him and with Joanne Rogers, Fred's widow, and I said, why don't we have a biography of Fred Rogers? He's this seminal figure in American culture, in education. I can't believe there's not a biography.
So Fred Rogers, while he was alive, did not want or just discouraged a biography, and why so?
Well, he discouraged a number of writers approached him, and he discouraged it because he didn't want it to be about him. He was modest. I think he was private also. And so during his lifetime, he didn't want a biography. And so Joanne and the family and the Archabbot had continued this. And I said to them, with all due respect, Fred is gone now. We're trying to raise $20 million to keep his legacy going. We need a biography. And finally, Joanne said yes, and then she turned the tables on me and said, why don't you write it?
Your idea, go ahead and write
it. Yeah.
Okay. Now, the longtime host of another childhood classic, Reading Rainbow, LeVar Burton, voiced the audiobook. Here he is describing a moment when Fred appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show and the response from the kids in the audience.
As soon as the children started to ask him questions directly, he seemed to get lost in their world, slowing his responses to their pace and even hunching in his chair as if to insinuate himself down to their level. This wasn't good television, at least good adult television. Everything was going into a kind of slow motion as Fred Rogers became Mr. Rogers, connecting powerfully with the smallest children present. He seemed to forget the camera as he focused on them, one by one.
Connecting. Very important word there. Why did Fred Rogers connect so well with kids? How did he understand them so well?
Dr. Margaret McFarlane, with whom he worked from the University of Pittsburgh in the 1950s, once said, Fred is so good with children because the child is still very much alive in him. Mm. He never really left his own childhood in a way. His own childhood was a great struggle. He was shy. He was lonely. He was introverted. He was sickly when he was a little boy. And his parents and his grandparents helped him through that period. And what Fred took out of that, first of all, he cared about childhood for the rest of his life. He sort of kept a part of his own childhood alive. And he took away from it also a great appreciation for how important caring adults are in the lives of young children.
You write that that loneliness, that isolation during his childhood, almost, you know, it sort of helped percolate that creative, artistic spirit within him. How so?
Well, he had a series of challenges when he was a little boy, and one was an incident of bullying where he was terrified, and he came home from that incident to talk to his parents. And his parents and his grandparents said, oh, Fred, just pretend you don't care. They'll leave you alone if you pretend you don't care. Now, this came after Fred had spent years sitting on the pew at La Trobe Presbyterian Church next to his mother at church and observing his mother, who was a devout Christian and a very, very caring, giving person, a volunteer throughout the community. And Fred went up to his bedroom after that event, and he sat there saying to himself, but I do care. I do care. And of course, Fred and his mother, for that matter, more than anything else in their lives, cared. And I think that began a sort of an internal dialogue in which Fred dealt with these issues, sort of talking to himself and fashioning an approach to life.
Did he fashion that approach of life through that caring, through that religious impact, through developing a love for music and puppetry?
Well, I think it was all of those things. He cared about the puppets, and he did puppet theater when he was a little boy. Music was the great solace in his life. And when he was a little boy, he was quite adept at the piano. He had sort of a toy piano when he was very young. He was very accomplished at that. And his grandmother, I won't tell the whole story, but a stunning moment, his grandmother bought him a Steinway concert grand piano.
How old was
he? He was about 10.
Oh, my.
But she trusted that this was important. And Fred kept that piano for the rest of his life. He took it to New York. He took it to Toronto. He took it into WQED. He wrote 200 songs on it. He wrote 12 operas. It literally changed his life, that devotion to music.
And yet, as you point out in the book, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers, you point out that, I guess like a lot of us, we're not sure what we want to do with our life, what our career is going to be, because he liked things. Was it ministry? Was it music? Could he make a living at music? And it's interesting, when he got to Rollins College after transferring from Dartmouth, music became an even more important part of his life. And also an incident when he went home for summer vacation.
Yeah. Well, Fred sort of wanted to do everything. He was a very bright young man, and he had a widely eclectic set of interests. He told his parents that he might become he was proficient in French, that he might become a language instructor. He thought he might become a diplomat. He thought he was going to become a Presbyterian minister. But when he was in his senior year at Rollins for spring break, he came home and he saw television. His parents had the first television set in that community. This was the late 1940s. Mm-hmm. And he had two reactions to it, very strong reactions. First of all, he was horrified at how simple-minded and even violent it was. Even back then, people were hurling pies in each other's faces. And then his second reaction was, almost uniquely, he saw the extraordinary educational potential of this new technology.
When did he, and of course at Rollins he met his future wife, Joanne, when did he sort of say, okay, television? Because you write in the book about his experiences in New York, but the commercial television wasn't quite for him because WQED sort of drew him back to Pittsburgh.
Well, Fred was a lucky guy. I mean, he made a lot of his luck by being hardworking, but he was a lucky guy. Joanne Rogers is the prime example of how fortunate he was. She's this wonderful life partner with an extraordinary sense of humor and as seriously spiritual as Fred and kind and giving as Fred, but much more lighthearted. And that was a great thing for Fred. But another great lucky event for Fred was he became an intern at NBC in the 1950s, in the early 1950s, at exactly the time when NBC was doing all these extraordinarily creative things. There was a producer there named Kirk Browning, and Fred trained under him. He became legendary. He won Emmys. He won Peabody's. And so Fred learned television in this very creative, high-minded environment. And when he came to public television, he brought that creativity with him.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left, and I want to get into what did he learn from that, and even his stint at the CBC. I think some advice he got, you said, was look into the lens and just talk.
Well, Gabby Hayes, who most people won't remember, but I do. I'm that old. I remember Gabby Hayes had a children's program on NBC, and Fred was the floor manager for a while for him. And Fred enjoyed talking to him because he was quite a character. And at one point, Gabby Hayes explained the secret to dealing with children. He said, "Fred, look into the camera and just think of one little buckaroo."
Yes, just, he used that term.
Yeah, you're just talking to one little buckaroo. And Fred told that story for the rest of his career.
So his favorite quote was, "What is essential is invisible to the eye." What do you mean by that? What did he think about that?
Well, it was part of Fred's spirituality. You know, although Fred was a Presbyterian minister and he was a devout Christian, his spirituality throughout his life widened and widened and widened. He read everybody from Lao Tzu, Confucius. He studied Buddhism, Jainism, Judaism, the Muslim faith. And his spirituality, while he remained a devout Christian, became almost pantheistic. And I think what he meant about that quote from a famous French author is that the spiritual component of life, which you don't see, is the most important aspect of life.
So much more to talk about, but just really a matter of 15 seconds. How did he make it seem like he was talking to a single child?
Authenticity. The key thing for Fred Rogers was he was utterly authentic, on camera, off camera, and children recognize that.
Maxwell King is CEO of the Pittsburgh Foundation. He's the former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he's written, now on the bestseller list, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. So many more anecdotes, so many more insights into his life. Maxwell King, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, the competition between two healthcare giants in Pittsburgh extends far beyond city borders. Cumberland County patients will soon get to choose between Highmark and UPMC right in the same block. NPR's David Green shares his hopes for the college football season and why his allegiances don't necessarily align with his own storied alma mater. Plus, a look at what it would take to make Pittsburgh a proper music city. Find more of The Confluence online at WESA.FM/Confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Stick with us on 90.5 WESA. Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Fans of hometown rapper Mac Miller, who died last week at the age of 26, said goodbye to the musician Tuesday. Fans crowded Blue Slide Park, a playground in Frick Park, which was the inspiration behind the title of Miller's first album. And the Planned Parenthood PAC is pumping $2.5 million into Governor Wolf's re-election campaign. The organization says it's the largest ever investment it's made on a midterm race. Find more top stories by signing up for our daily newsletter at WESA.FM/inbox edition.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh area residents are well aware of the Highmark UPMC rivalry, from insurance to care providers. But that rivalry extends beyond the Pittsburgh region. Highmark-affiliated Penn State Health is moving forward with plans to build a 108-bed hospital in Cumberland County. It's right across the interstate from the UPMC Pinnacle Hospital. WITF's Brett Schultes looks at what the move means for consumers.
It's a 44-acre grass field off Interstate 81 in Cumberland County. Penn State Health paid $12 million for it last year. The health system is building a hospital there, saying it puts people on the West Shore closer to the services they need. The location happens to be about a 5-minute drive from another hospital owned by Highmark's bitter rival, UPMC. Penn State Health Chief Strategy Officer Tom Stasel says the decision to build there has nothing to do with a competitor.
So the reality is we looked sort of far and wide, and this was simply the best piece of land that we could locate and come up with a reasonable financial deal on. that also serves our purposes.
But Robert Morris healthcare and economics professor Stephen Foreman says competition among health systems is heating up in the mid-state, and it's not the first time a hospital has planted its flag so close to another one. He notes in 2012, the UPMC East Hospital was built about 1 mile from Highmark's Forbes Hospital in Monroeville, east of Pittsburgh.
My concern is, in the long run, is the public going to be paying for this competition? If there are more hospital beds built than we really need, and you could probably make a case for that, does that mean consumers pay more? And the answer to that's probably yes.
Foreman says he's seen something similar happen in Allegheny County, where UPMC and Highmark excluded rival hospitals to one another's in-network insurance plans. The state insurance department stepped in, creating a consent decree requiring them to accept one another's insurances in some cases. That consent decree expires next summer. Foreman says consumers should expect their insurance to start excluding hospitals that are in a rival health system, something known as narrow networks.
5 years ago, almost all insurers let almost anyone be in network. Networks were broad. People had a choice of where they went for a physician and where they went for a hospital. Now, as the competition has heated up, everybody's trying to get patients into their own hospital. So they're using insurance as a way to do that.
For its part, Highmark says it's locked in an agreement to keep UPMC hospitals in network until 2025, 4 years after the scheduled completion of the hospital. UPMC Pinnacle didn't say whether Penn State hospitals are or will continue to be in network. At the insurance department, Chief of Staff Allison Beam says such a decision is within the right of insurance companies as long as they meet the state's standard of providing sufficient access to care.
One of the things that the insurance department always advises consumers is to make sure that as you're purchasing a product, that you review the network of that product.
At Penn State Health, Stasel stresses that the planned hospital meets demand in the fast-growing region.
Today, on any given day, Hershey Medical Center is above 100% occupancy, and we often are in a situation where we cannot take the number of patients in from other facilities who are trying to transfer patients to us.
Professor Foreman says one thing is for sure. For consumers, it's better to have a few health systems competing than to have only one remaining.
Really, what's created this is that we've let the market become so concentrated. You don't have a lot of small firms competing. You've got two big firms competing, and they can make decisions, and basically they wouldn't suffer the same consequences if a small firm made a bad decision and had to go under.
He says for a region with economic growth outpacing much of the state, this is likely the beginning of a lot more competition to come. In Hampton Township, Cumberland County, I'm Brett Schultes.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Pittsburgh sports fan extraordinaire David Green, host of NPR's Morning Edition. Hey, David.
Hey, Kevin.
From our earlier chats, our listeners know that you are a huge Steelers fan, Pirates fan, Penguins fan. What about college sports? Do you have any connections to the Pittsburgh region via college sports?
Yeah, Pitt. I mean, my mom, when I was growing up in Pittsburgh, she was in grad school at Pitt, and we'd go to a lot of games at the old Pitt Stadium. And it was fun.
I want to talk a little bit more about Pitt, but I mean, you're a Harvard grad, so are you a Crimson fan?
That's a really complicated question, Kevin.
I touched a spot.
So when I went to Harvard, I was, coming from Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, and then Lancaster. And, my Steelers fandom and football games to me are about football. And yes, there is a great tradition of Harvard football. I mean, they like to say that they were the team of the 90s, meaning the 1890s. But so I would go on a Saturday and we'd be tailgating and tailgating and tailgating and tailgating, and it would be time for the game to start. And I would be saying to everyone, like, are we going in to watch the game? And everyone would be like, what are you talking about? I mean, we're drinking beer. We're out in the parking lot. I was like, there's football to watch. So it was not as taken seriously as I would have liked it to be. So I paid a little more attention to more important, larger college football games. But I was a committed fan, and, especially, I mean, basketball, too. When Harvard's women's basketball team, beat a 16, was 16th seed and beat a number one seed in the tournament, I mean, that was really exciting. And, so I love Harvard. I had a lot of friends who were athletes. I can't say that football games are exactly satisfying.
All right. So, Pitt finished 5-7 last year.
Yeah.
You were talking about Coach Narduzzi. At the kickoff luncheon, he told Pitt fans, quote, "Next time we'll see you, we'll be in Charlotte for the ACC championship game because we're going." Boy, a bit of bravado for a 5-7 last year team.
Yeah. Haven't they almost lost to Youngstown State twice under it?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, better if he can put something behind those words, then more power to him. What do you think? Has he been the coach you thought he'd be?
I was expecting the defense to be much better than it has been. And I am anticipating an improved defense this year. I really am. He has to insist on it because that, as you said, that is his claim to fame, a defensive genius. So I can ask you about rivalries. I mean, you always told us about Steelers, New England, Steelers, Ravens, Penguins, Capitals, etc. Do you like great college football rivalries? And if so, would you prefer a Pitt-Penn State ongoing rivalry or a Pitt-West Virginia ongoing rivalry?
God, I think they're both great. I think they're two of the best sort of backyard brawls in all of college sports. But Pitt-Penn State has something really special, and I like the underdog feel that Pitt always has, you know, especially in recent years. I mean, against Penn State, and if Pitt could get to a point where they're respected a lot, but still going into that rivalry as kind of the underdog. I mean, I think that's really cool. And, you know, when I moved to Lancaster, you know, that's total Penn State country. I mean, on a Saturday morning, there would sometimes be traffic, and this was sort of just lore in some ways, but there'd be traffic in Lancaster early in the morning, and it was people, you know, lining up to start making the drive to State College. I mean, you just see the insanity of the fandom elsewhere in Pennsylvania. So to be a Pitt fan as part of that rivalry, you know, you kind of feel like, you know, you're an underdog, and you know, but always threatening.
Well, David, hail to Pitt.
Hail to Pitt.
He's Pittsburgh sports fan and NPR Morning Edition host David Green. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Kevin. It's always fun.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Bridges, rivers, football and hockey, meds and eds, and this time of year, maybe even a zombie or two. When Pittsburgh comes up in national conversation, it's usually about one of those things. But maybe what isn't often on that list of talking points is Pittsburgh's music scene. Why is that? Well, last fall, our sister station, WYEP, announced an initiative with the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership and the City of Pittsburgh to study our city's music scene and its sustainability. Results of the study have been published, so what can we expect moving forward? Joining me to talk about that is the study's author, Don Pitts, an Austin, Texas-based consultant with Sound Music Cities. Don, welcome to The Confluence.
Yes, thank you.
And in studio is WYEP's general manager, Abby Goldstein. Abby, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right, let's start from the beginning. Abby, were there clear issues with Pittsburgh's music economy that you saw and you wanted some more information about and that prompted this study?
Well, yes. I mean, as you said, Kevin, you know, Pittsburgh's been touted in recent years for all of these great amenities, livability, affordability, high culture, sports, food scene, tech boom, and startups. But nowhere was local music sort of present in that conversation. And so I started asking questions about why this amazing music scene wasn't the same source of civic pride. And, you know, we've got this amazing base of world-class talent right here in Pittsburgh, internationally renowned jazz players, top-notch metal, pop, and indie rock bands. And so the more I started asking questions, the more I discovered that I wasn't the only person asking these questions. There were other community leaders that were having the same discussions. And so we put this partnership together initially with the goal of looking at the regulatory environment that we thought might be the source of what was holding the music scene back in terms of permitting and sound ordinance and things of that sort. But the more we started pulling at it, the more we realized that all of these things are interrelated. You can't engage a wider audience without great venues, and you can't have great venues without a regulatory environment that's supportive. Artists can't improve their work if they don't have the time and space and venues to make that happen. And we discovered through this study that a huge portion of the creative workforce here in Pittsburgh is working full time in other industries. So, so as we started peeling back the layers of the onion, we discovered that this really is an ecosystem where all of these pieces are completely interrelated.
What genres of music are we talking about?
All genres of music. I mean, I think when we look at the classical music scene in Pittsburgh with it, with the symphony, I think there's a little bit more of a sustainability picture there, a little bit more of a healthy ecosystem when it comes to classical music, because our symphony is so well-funded and internationally renowned.
Don, you heard from focus groups, conducted interviews, you heard from, I believe, about 1,800 online respondents. Are we talking about all stakeholders here that gave their input?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we were pleased with the quality of the diverse input from all the sectors in the ecosystem.
Did you notice any sort of general consensus from the respondents about the status of Pittsburgh's music economy? Don, let's start with you, then Abby.
Well, the consensus, I think, was that there was just an overwhelming sense of frustration. You know, primarily just, by nature, music ecosystems are somewhat, siloed and fragmented. Some people call them cliques. I think the Pittsburgh description, they use the word clique a lot. We like to say silo and fragmentation, fragmented. But I think overwhelmingly there was just a sense of frustration that there was just no use to even have this conversation.
Abby?
Well, I think that what is most interesting to me is that it seems that folks in the local music scene feel like their only revenue generating activities are playing live gigs and selling their recorded music, when we know that there are 250 different revenue streams internationally that musicians access, everywhere from teaching to publishing to, or recording for soundtrack work. And a lot of those revenue streams aren't here in the market. And so our artists have to go outside of the market to make a living doing what they love to do. Or they have to find full-time jobs outside of the industry here, which cuts the amount of time they have to actually get better at their craft.
Yeah, I know a lot of artists, they have to supplement their performing income, if you would, by teaching. And that is a good opportunity if that opportunity is there.
Right. Well, and so I think one of the charges that this ecosystem study puts on the table for us is how do we build up the revenue base and those revenue streams so that musicians here in Pittsburgh either don't have to leave to make a living, or there's more meat on the bone here for them to be able to make a living doing what they love to do so that they can improve and get better and engage audiences.
Don, the results and recommendations of the study found room for improvement in a few categories, like the need for leadership development and reforms of some of the city's regulations. Would you say that Pittsburgh is experiencing some of the same challenges, unique challenges, as other cities that you've studied?
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, we like to say that a lot of cities that we look at, and we're in Charlotte right now and in Seattle, there's a lot of the challenges are very similar, but the causes of those challenges are unique to the city. But, Pittsburgh had a lot of policies that weren't necessarily music friendly. I think the one case right now that's coming up with the Mac Miller naming the park after him, I think is where the city ordinance in Pittsburgh allows a 3-year posthumous where you can award or name anything after someone.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and that, although it doesn't Abby, that has repercussions and I guess even a sense of appreciation or policy might get in the way of appreciation of an artist and shows that sort of encouragement for our current artists who are living in this area.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of little, large and small things that are sort of baked into city policy and city code that we might not think have an effect on how people view the local music economy or the local music scene, but they really do. You know, right down to referring to sound issues as noise complaints. Mm-hmm. That just sort of makes it sound pejorative when really the point is that, you know, sound is a good thing. So, I mean, it's little things like that. It's how we think about it. It's how we talk about it.
I want to ask you both this question. Do we want to have sort of a central music corridor? Memphis is Beale Street, Louisville's 4th Street, New Orleans, of course, Bourbon Street. Donald, I'll start with you. Should Pittsburgh have a central music corridor?
You know, that was those central corridors were I think, big in the last, you know, 20, 30 years. But I think there's inherent problems with having your entertainment districts, you know, very highly concentrated, from accessibility to they usually kind of take a life of their own. I know in Austin and New Orleans and Beale Street, all those cities are struggling with kind of those entertainment districts turning into a wild, wild west. And I think what we're seeing in some other cities where the music venues are all spread out, you know, are pretty much geographically spread out close to where the people are living.
So Pittsburgh is a city of neighborhoods, and we are extremely emotionally tied to those neighborhoods. There's a lot of pride about those neighborhoods. So I actually think that our decentralized approach is a competitive strength for Pittsburgh. You know, we always talk about how people don't want to cross the rivers. And so if you force people to cross the rivers to go hear the bands they love to hear, then they may have a harder time developing those audiences. And, you know, you're seeing amazing things happening on the North Side. North Side Leadership Conference and the folks at Deutschtown Music Festival have done a remarkable job of building music in that neighborhood. Lawrenceville doing an amazing job of building music in that neighborhood. So I kind of think that there's an advantage there. I think it would be helpful to have a central music district in Pittsburgh, but I don't think we can ignore the fact that what's happening now and the DIY nature of it is there's strength in it.
Yeah, come explore our neighborhood while you're checking out our artist scene.
Exactly.
Okay. So the study found that many creatives could benefit by working with other professionals when it comes to booking shows, managing record label relationships, even social media marketing. That do-it-yourself attitude, I mean, that can be commendable. That can be admirable, but maybe it's not the most successful way of doing things, Don?
No, it's a challenge. We're finding, you know, as Abby mentioned before, I mean, there's over 250 revenue streams, you know, for today's independent musician. And I think what we're seeing in Pittsburgh and in other cities is we can't just say here's 250 revenue streams. So I think the challenge for us is to really coming up with programs and models that help these musicians kind of navigate. We call them kind of navigators. And I think attaching a pipeline to the local universities is a theme that's coming up in a lot of other cities. I think Pittsburgh is blessed with an amazing amount of you know, top-notch universities that could provide some of that pipeline.
Abby, what about the cost of hiring a manager or hiring help, if you would? When the study looked at what musicians can earn solely based on the music that you alluded to a little earlier, what did they find, and also, can they afford it?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, I don't know that there's enough revenue being generated in that sector in Pittsburgh to support the level of management and booking that that artists really need. Kevin, I'd like to sort of go back to that DIY question.
Sure.
I think it's all super excellent if people have the right tools, if they know what they're doing, if they understand the bigger picture. And so I think part of what we want to try to accomplish with this study is to give people those tools, to give people that basic education so that you can go do it yourself, but that you know what you're doing in a do-it-yourself environment. There's a lot going on here, and there's a lot of people that are really pushing at growth and sustainability, and so we want to just try to help them get there.
Don, I mean, really, let's put it down to the economics. It is difficult to make it a go, and how many artists, how many performers are really making it a go on the music itself?
Yeah, I mean, it's not our parents' music industry. I mean, even the changes in the last 5 years have been dramatic. But I think what we're finding also is that there's just different levels of success that artists are actually want. Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that we failed to ask, you know, Pittsburgh musicians in the survey is, are they happy where they're at? I mean, one of the things that we've changed on some of the other surveys is, you know, we talk about musicians are only making $10,000 and $15,000 a year off their music. But what we're finding out is there's a large portion of those musicians that when we started asking the question, are they happy? Some of them are fine with that because they only want to, you know, their definition of success is completely different from someone else's.
And Don, that is exactly what I was going to jump in and say. It all depends on how you define success and what you are trying to achieve as an artist. Some artists are absolutely fine keeping it homegrown and doing their thing right here in Pittsburgh. And some artists really want much larger success and they want to build a fan base nationally and they want to, you know, get out there and make it big. And so it really just all depends on how you define success. So I had a conversation with a local musician as this project was getting going. And this was a person who was paying their mortgage and their bills and having a marriage all just on that music income. So it can be done.
Okay. We have just 2 minutes left. I guess it's everybody or all the stakeholders, the musicians, the artists, government officials, everybody, the venues, are they all pulling in the same direction? And is that the first challenge to overcome?
That is the biggest challenge, Kevin. That is the whole enchilada right there. Getting everybody rowing in the same direction. You know, the idea here isn't we want to upend your pirate ship. The idea is let's get all the pirate ships rowing in the same direction.
Don, what are the next steps? What's the next big step? Is it that, getting everybody to the table and agreeing?
Yeah, I think the next step is getting some leadership to step up and take some of these areas that was in the report that came up through the study and research and say, I want to put together a group to tackle some of these things and not necessarily wait on everyone else to get in the game.
This is a community project. It's a community issue, and the solutions are within the community. So this is for everyone.
All right, last minute. The city of Pittsburgh was one of the partners, if you would, in driving this. How much onus is on them? What can they really do?
Well, really look at that regulatory environment and understand how those things ripple down to the grassroots level. And I will say that the city has been pretty open-minded about looking at things like zoning and the, you know, 311 sound complaint process. So it's there. There's a lot of potential there.
Don, the last 20 seconds go to you.
Oh my goodness. well, I think to echo Abby's, you know, comment about the city. I mean, I think the city's really primary responsibility is regulatory reform, and engaging the right stakeholders to be able to have a constructive conversation.
All right. Don Pitts is an Austin, Texas-based consultant with Sound Music Cities and the author of this comprehensive look into Pittsburgh's music scene. Abby Goldstein is the general manager of 91.3 WYEP, who spearheaded this study along with the City of Pittsburgh and the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, Janice Burley Wilson has been at the helm of the August Wilson Center for a bit more than a year. What has she been doing to rebuild the organization financially and through creative programming to help reach the center's fullest potential? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.